Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today's speech, titled Solving the Wrong Problem, Nuclear Waste and Risk Perception, was given recently before the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations in Camden. The speaker is Gary Brewer, Professor of Resource Policy and Management at the Yale School of Management. Brewer is the author of a number of books, including Decision-Making for the Environment. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for the Audio On Demand section, where you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Introducing the speaker is Mac DeFord, President of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations.
Good afternoon. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which was founded in 1983 by a small group of people living in the Mid-Coast area with an interest in the U.S. role in international relations. If you are interested in further information about us, please go to our website, midcoastforum, all one word, .org. Today's speaker is Gary Brewer, who is currently the Frederick Weyerhaus Professor of Resource Policy and Management at the Yale School of Management. A policy scientist, he was educated at Berkeley, San Diego State, and Yale, and began his career at the RAND Corporation in 1970. Before coming to Yale, he was dean of the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. He has worked in Sweden, where he was elected to the Royal Swedish Academy, and taught at Berkeley as well. His most recent book was Decision-Making for the Environment. We're excited to have Professor Brewer with us today to discuss a topic of particular importance, and that is solving the wrong problem, nuclear waste and risk perception. Gary.
First of all, I would like to thank everyone in the forum for inviting me and my wife, Shelley, who's sitting there in orange at the table, and also to acknowledge an old friendship with Judy Stein and her husband, Mike. They're dear people, sweet people, and really, really old friends. And I could keep going, all right. I should add one or two personal notes to give you some idea of why I'm about to tell you the things that I am. I have been involved in one way or another with nuclear matters since coming of age at the RAND Corporation in the late 60s and 70s by doing wargaming, trying to figure out how to use the weapons, and then worrying about the command and control of nuclear weapons, the so-called C3I problem, command, control, and intelligence, and then decided that I was really tired of doing nuclear things and went off and became an environmentalist, going to Yale when they started their management school and worrying about the environment and business and so on. Well, I've backed into the nuclear game because nuclear power is important. It's one of the things I'm going to talk about today. What to do with the waste is important, but not as important as climate change. And thinking about what to do with nuclear waste, I had occasion to be appointed by the first President Bush to the Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board, on which I sat for 6 years. And that's the body that worries about Yucca Mountain, worries about very technical details of where to put the waste and what's likely to happen to it and so forth. It's a $10 billion risk assessment, which in the current circumstances and political situation is probably going to be set aside. And so that's another element in my talk. It's another element in the idea of solving the wrong problem. Now, I have a lot to do today, and I desperately want to, and there's no way the topic can be discussed in anything like a simple way, because it's not a simple topic. I want very much, based on some really, really informed questions and conversation at a social event last night with some of the board members here, to leave time for questions and answers. I will promise to listen to the questions, and I'll do my best with the answers, but I'm not going to promise about that, okay, because these are very, very tough issues. Now, here is sort of the idea of the talk. Climate change is the problem on the table facing all of us, not just in the United States, but around the world. It's a global problem. It's a problem that is urgent. It is dangerous. And for a lot of different reasons, it can look intractable, but we can't let it look that way. We have to do something. We have to do a lot of somethings. It's also increasingly clear to a lot of people, including those who don't like nuclear power or worry about the waste, that as nice as the renewables are and as virtuous as many of the people are who really believe strongly in renewables, and I'm one of them, it's not going to be enough. And it's certainly not going to be enough to rely on renewables to take up the entire slack from nuclear in terms of base loads in this country, in Europe, and here's the rub, more importantly, in places like India and China in the emerging markets of the world. All right, there's my argument. And what I propose to do in the next 25 or 30 minutes is to talk very briefly about climate change. These are arguments that you've all heard, but it's important that we recite them so we all kind of know where we are. To look at the difference between coal as an energy, that is to say electric source, a power source, versus the non-greenhouse gases, nuclear being one of them, and look at what the trade-offs are, because coal is the resource of choice in places like China, places like South Africa, and lo and behold, places like the United States of America, where we have a 250-year supply of the stuff in the ground, and we're consuming it as rapidly as we can. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the, quote, renaissance in the nuclear world and some of the very unlikely people who are all of a sudden embracing it as inevitable. And it's a really interesting cast of characters, including national characters, that are changing their mind about very, very strong convictions and decisions made individually and nationally. I want to spend a moment or two talking about one of the new nuclear technologies in the so-called fourth generation, which seems to offer a lot of hope. It's not the only one of the new technologies. You know, while things have been going on and going on, there is research and development around the world in power plants that were designed from the ground up to be smaller, safer, more efficient than the ones that are in the current fleet. By the way, I won't ask, there are too many people here, and probably someone knows the answer, so I'm not going to get in that position. How many nuclear, I'm asking and answering my own question. This is a Don Rumsfeld trick. How many nuclear power plants are in the world fleet at the moment, generating power all around the world? And the answer is 436. And it's very interesting. When you ask the same question about the United States, the answer is right now 102 at 73 sites scattered all over the United States of America. And we have not contracted for or built one since 1978. And that becomes a real important issue. And just what are we going to do to replace the base load as these power plants come offline, much less what will we do if we're going to try to conform to any agreement that we may find ourselves getting into in Copenhagen or beyond to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, to level out the CO2 in the atmosphere. So it's not only just replacing what we've got, but if we're serious, we're probably going to have to add more than the 102. All right. And then I'll spend, if we've got time, just a couple of words about one of my least favorite places on the planet, Yucca Mountain at the nuclear test site in Nevada, where I've spent too much time. All right, climate change, some of the big things. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change got its Nobel Prize. Okay, basically there are hundreds of scientists around the world who are trying to find consensus, trying to collect the data, trying to make a coherent story so that people can realize that this is a real problem. It is the real problem for all of us in the next 100 years. Temperatures up 1.3 degrees in the last 100 years. They're going to go up at least that much in the next 100. Since 1990, 12 of the hottest years on record, including 1998, which is the hottest year in 1,000 years, according to the ice cores. When I say 12 of the hottest years on record, we only have instrumented temperatures for the globes from about 1864, 65. But the ice cores, the Greenland cores, are clean, and they're able to say, yeah, 98 was the hottest in 1,000 years, and that's really pretty impressive. Lots of other evidence, evaporation problems, rainfall, too much, too little, wrong place, permafrost going, glaciers going, sea ice going. The Arctic is interesting, and this is a group that's worried about diplomacy. You know, the next stampede for resources and claims, with us not even signing up to the law of the sea, will be in the Arctic. It's already happening. Coral bleaching is another indicator, and now we're worrying about ocean acidification, more CO2. The ocean is becoming measurably more acidic. Only takes a little bit, and lots of funny things can be happening. It's happening. Multiple stressors on ecosystems and so forth, and the sea level's rising. Folks with property on islands, like us on Sanibel, this is a concern, but I've got a boat, and and it might be in my front yard instead of on my dock. I don't know. The human stuff, we know that we're responsible. It could be as much as 4 degrees warmer by 2100. The revisions of the scientists, you know, they're always fiddling around with what they know and trying to refine things. And when the original fourth report of the IPCC came out, they're saying 1 to 2, and now they're saying maybe 4 as they relook at the data and they kind of update things. That is a lot. That's a lot. Sea level rise about 50 centimeters on average expected by 2100. That's a lot. It's half a meter. Rain patterns, storm tracks, precip, hot and cold extremes, and so on. We're all seeing this stuff. Now, the interesting thing is that we're a fairly adaptable species, and species in the world are fairly adaptable, but this is happening too fast. We've never seen rates of change like this a couple of times in the historic geologic record, but so long ago that it's not particularly relevant. So it's the question of, with these rates of change in the climate, how do we mitigate, which is put less CO2 in and try to level things off to slow it down, or how do we adapt? I mean, those are the two strategies that we've got, and the mitigation strategy is the one that that basically is of greatest interest when talking about power, because it's one of the areas where we can actually start to do something to reduce the amount of CO2. There are other greenhouse gases, as you all know, but CO2 is the one I'm talking about today. Well, we can be more efficient. And smart grids, I don't know if you've been watching, there's a big demonstration in, of all places, Boulder, Colorado. The People's Republic of Boulder, Colorado, is really involved in a very, very substantial way in trying to get intelligent grids, very important for renewables, so that we can become much more efficient in the houses and so on. Transitions in the economy from manufacturing and other things that actually generate greenhouse gases to a service-based economy. We saw this in the late 70s in the U.S. economy, so it's possible. It's not going to happen, though, in places like India and China, probably. There isn't that quick step from being an emerging economy without some sort of mass. It's got to be manufacturing stuff somewhere in the world, and these are the places of great concern. We can switch from coal to oil and gas, because oil and gas don't put per unit of energy generated as much CO2 in the atmosphere. Some of that goes on, but oil and gas is not cheap, and prices are volatile. We can capture carbon and sequester it, CCS it's called, and this is the big hope for coal-fired power plants. I have been for the last 5 years on the Department of Energy's oversight for CCS programs in this country. Let me tell you, it's not going to happen soon, and it's not going to be cheap, if it happens at all. And the major plant that was the demonstration plant for carbon capture and sequestration was 5 times over its budget. And so in this last administration, they just pulled the plug on it. So as a major R&D effort, we've just stopped, for all intents and purposes, worrying about CCS on the coal plants. It's a very hard technology, as it turns out, and very expensive. But there it is. It's one of the things that we can hold out hope for to reduce or even remove. And then the other thing is to plant lots of trees, because trees, in good circumstances, pick up carbon, CO2 out of the atmosphere and hold it. You know, for as long as the tree's around, we don't burn it down or chop it down. Now, a couple of facts, points to keep in mind about coal versus the non-greenhouse gas ways of making power, nuclear being one of them. In this country, 40% of our electric power is generated from basically CO2 emitting things, and of that, 80% is coal. The other part is oil and gas. So a third of the CO2 that we generate in the country is from coal. I mean, that's a way to think about this. Transport is about a third. These are rough numbers, obviously. And the problem here, of course, is that coal is cheap, and I've already said it's plentiful and it's dirty, and we're not the only ones that've got it in the world, and we're going to use it. And that is very troubling, because it's putting that much CO2 into the atmosphere. Of the non-greenhouse gas sources, nuclear accounts for 70% of the electricity that we generate, non-greenhouse gas. Hydro is about 24%. Now, here's the renewable part, folks. 7% of all other possible sources for generating electricity as we sit here comes from renewables or not nuclear or not hydro. And that's wood, it's waste, it's solar, about 1%, 2% at most right at the moment. All these things are absolutely wonderful. We've got to do as much as we possibly can to get power that doesn't generate greenhouse gases. Let me tell you, it's not going to cover the 69% in this category that nuclear does, or roughly 20% of the total in the country. And renewables are not easy. You look at the wind project off of Cape Cod, Cape Wind. You'd think, my goodness, everyone would be just really excited about having windmills out there generating all that electricity, and they are excited. They hate it. They are really excited. So there's a problem, citing problems with all this stuff, and windmills are fine in somebody else's backyard or front yard or in view. Most of the renewables are not real good at covering so-called base load. Base load is 40 to 45% of what a country, a modern economy needs. That is to say, you got to have it reliable at a very high 99-point-something percent, and it's got to be there all the time, 24/7, and so forth. And you look at the renewables, the wind blows, it stops, the sun shines, it doesn't, and so base load coverage from the renewables is a sometime thing. And often, where the wind blows and the sun shines is not where you need the power, and so you've got distribution problems as well. And some of these things, like burning waste or burning wood, are polluting. I remember in the 70s, in the energy crisis, everyone went to wood-burning stoves and then got lung disease of one sort or another in their house. All right. Here's one of the things that is not well known, and I'm about to make you part of the cognoscenti here. We didn't build all of our nuclear power plants in this country at the same time, or we didn't do it in a nice, neat way, like 10 a year over 10 years or something like that. We didn't do that. We built them in a couple of lumps. The lumps are about to go out of business. That's not an elegant way of putting this problem, but it's a cohort aging problem. And starting next year, folks, even with extensions of their normal 40-year licenses by 10, or in some cases they're trying for 20-year extensions these days to keep the nuclear guys in business, we are about to see more and more U.S. nuclear power plants decommissioned because they are running out of life. These things wear down. That's what nuclear power plants do in 40, 50, 60 years. And so we start this accelerating curve. I'm using my hands here to make the thing, or going off a cliff. It depends on which way you look at this problem. By 2020, if we don't do anything, half, that is 50 plus or minus, of the current nuclear power plants, that is 20-some percent of the power in the country, electric power in the country, will be offline. By the way, it takes anywhere from 10 to 20 years to build one of these, given the current regulatory environment and the construction difficulties and so forth. And if they're coming offline and we're not building them, we've got to find the power someplace. And the obvious thing is burn more coal or peak power out of gas, you know, peaking power out of jet turbines, basically. And those things generate more CO2. And if we're locked into various international agreements, which we have not so far been locked into, but this administration seems on its way to locking us into something, we're in a real bind in terms of this is a real problem, folks, a real problem. Now, the final sort of note in this tale about us getting out of the nuclear business, 2035 plus or minus a year, if we don't do anything, all of the existing power plants in the fleet, U.S. fleet, will be decommissioned. 2035, maybe 2040, depends on extending licenses and how serious things become in the next 5 to 10 years in terms of lost electricity. By the way, I have environmental students who show up in my classes and they're all gung-ho about hydrogen, you know, running the cars. And I say, fine, but where's the hydrogen coming from? You don't just pull it out of the air. Or the Volt and all the electric cars, you're going to plug the electric cars into the grid. Well, I mean, there's some discussion about them being able to put power back into the grid, but we don't have a grid that will let them do that because we have a dumb grid. We don't have a smart grid. So there are a lot of problems here that have got to be dealt with, all related to how are we going to stop putting CO2 into the atmosphere. Now, Europe is very interesting. It's the next place where I want to go for a minute or two. They are more dependent upon nuclear for their electricity than we are. And they are much better, all this stuff is relative, in terms of car efficiencies, in terms of trying to put taxes on carbon. They have a market for CO2 in the cap and trade view of the world that we're flirting with. It's legislation pending in the Congress right now to cap and trade and create markets for carbon to get us to figure out ways to reduce the amount of carbon that we put in, fine, but where's the electricity going to come from? That's the question. Europeans have tried all this without an enormous amount of success. Some success, more success than here, but still not enough. And their dependence on nuclear is much more than ours, and their sensitivity to the need to maybe rethink some major decisions made by nations, and I'm thinking now of Sweden, Germany, to renew their nuclear programs are on the table right at the moment. Now, quickly, France, 77% of the electricity in France is nuclear. It's the third largest component in terms of trade, export, income for the country of France is nuclear power, which is something you'd never thought of. They also make a lot of money on reprocessing nuclear fuels for the Japanese, the Italians, and the British, which a lot of people don't know. So for the French, it's business. It's serious business. And they figure very prominently in worldwide efforts to go to the third and fourth generations of nuclear power around the world. They're in it with up to their eyeballs, in fact. Lithuania, 65%. Okay, it's a bunch of bad Russian reactors, basically what they've got. Slovakia, Belgium, 55%. Sweden, 46%. Slovenia, 45%. Hungary, Bulgaria, 35%. Czechoslovakia, Finland, 30%, 35%. Germany, 26%. Just numbers don't matter. The point I'm trying to make is the Europeans, all of them, East and West, former East, West, really, really depend on this stuff. And it's not clear if they don't have nuclear where, in terms of trying to reduce their burdens of CO2. By the way, a lot of the signatories to the Kyoto Protocols aren't measuring up. Even in this crummy world economy, they're not measuring up, which I think is a very interesting point. You know, holier than thou, sign the treaty and then not measure up is I don't know whether that's worse than not signing the treaty, but here we are. It's my view. What about nuclear? Well, it's no greenhouse gases. In this country, we've had really pretty good performance to excellent performance for more than 50 years out of reactors that were never initially designed to be electric power plant reactors. The origins of the nuclear industry, which I don't want to get into, are really build nuclear submarine power plants. And, oh, by the way, we can also generate electricity at shipping port, Duquesne Electric, and so forth. And, you know, the fleet, right? And the word fleet, I think, is interesting, too, because it's Navy Propulsion Systems, Rickover and Company, a man who was both the Atomic Energy Commission and Navy. He had two phones on his desk, among other things. The transport issue of nuclear materials is a big bugaboo when talking about how we're going to get all the waste to Yucca Mountain, and it costs hundreds of millions of dollars trying to figure it out. Well, I asked the question in a public meeting once, well, how do you think all that nuclear stuff got to the power plants in the first place? The Tooth Fairy did not deliver the fuel rods to the power plants. And while we've had a few accidents, we have very, very strict protocols classified, but and they have been rethought and even made tougher for moving the stuff around, and we've done, I think, a very commendable job in 50 years, certainly a lot more so than with hazardous chemicals and certainly on and on and on. So there we are. So with a non-optimal Generation 2 power plants in this country, we've had 50 good years. It's done a lot for us. We've done it safely, and it's time to kind of rethink in terms of solving this other problem, this much larger problem. It's time to rethink, you know, kind of what we're all about. All right. Doing okay on time, not great. I've said the Renaissance in Europe and Asia, this is where the Renaissance in nuclear energy production is going on. Europeans have tried by having heavy taxes on cars to make them more efficient, by directly taxing carbon in a few countries, Sweden being one, by creating a carbon market in Europe, which has not been terribly successful because they can't find a price for a ton of carbon in the atmosphere. It's been very hard. By the way, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, the 10 states here in New England, which some of you may be involved in or know about, the auctions for REGI, RGGI, carbon credits, the market just won't settle. And let me tell you, $9 a ton for carbon or carbon equivalent, which is kind of where the market wants to be, is not what it should be. We just don't have enough players, and we just don't know what the market is. And until that happens, this cap-and-trade stuff is not going to work. And it's Europeans have been trying now for 6 years, and they still don't have a solid price. Now we got Russia. Russia with its vast oil and gas reserves and the pipeline through the Ukraine. Europeans painfully aware in two cold winters that you don't want to be dependent upon oil and gas if it's got to go through a Russian pipeline. And so this is focusing some of the attention in places like Sweden, Germany, and Finland on the need to be independent of that or to have some options at least. Now, Robert May, was the science advisor to the English government during the Blair years, is a friend, was the most anti-nuclear guy on the planet. He's an ecologist. He thinks nuclear is dreadful. I've served on a couple of National Academy committees with him. He's now on record, and this is a direct quote from Sir Robert, "It's difficult to see how we can reduce our dependence on fossil fuels without the help of nuclear power." And he must have gagged when he said that. Jim Lovelock of Gaia fame, you know, the Mother Earth, just he's the Father Earth person. Earth is a living organism and so on. Also a friend. He says we can't get out of the climate change issue unless we have nuclear. And the nuclear's got to be more efficient. There's got to be a lot of it. The waste issue is something that we're going to have to manage, and I've got a couple of quick ideas in a moment or two. The Renaissance is also driven by the commercial possibilities here. If you agree with the current science advisor to this president, John Holdren, who was a colleague at Berkeley of mine, we're going to need between 350 and 450 new nuclear power plants to not only cover the loss of the decommissioned fleet, the 102 that are coming offline, but to level off our contribution to CO2. We're going to need twice as many, maybe three times as many, 1,000 megawatt plants just to take care of what would be a range of possibilities for our contribution to CO2 in the atmosphere and to maintain the power supply that will be lost by the coming offline of the current fleet. It'd be interesting, because John said that before he was the science advisor to this administration, with Senator Reid being the senior senator from Nevada, worrying about nuclear waste in his state and so forth. It'd be really interesting to see what John has to say about it now, but he's on record in several places for having said those numbers, 350, 450, 1,000 megawatt power plants. For us just to maintain the amount that we're getting from nuclear now, plus paying attention to any kind of a commitment internationally that we may find ourselves in. Other actors are really interesting. Finland, first country in the world to have a designated repository. Repository is where you really put it away forever. And they're in the midst of trying to build one of the largest commercial power plants, cooperating with the French. There they are again, and several other countries. And they're having problems. It's over budget, it's late, and engineering issues and so forth. It's part of the story of nuclear power, because we tend to do things, everyone is different, and everyone presents different problems. The Swedes. After Chernobyl, I've spent a lot of time in Sweden, as I was introduced. Very much anti-nuclear. They're fearful of it. It was the Swedes who discovered Chernobyl. There were radiation detectors that were going off at Forsmark, which is one of their nuclear power plants. They thought the detectors were broken, and so they brought new detectors in, and they weren't broken. And a lot of the stuff out of Chernobyl dumped on Sweden and northern Scandinavia, and they're still doing full-body counts on the Laplanders, trying to see what the long-term effects are. Well, Sweden did not stop training nuclear engineers at the Royal Institute of Technology, and they're in the business of getting back into the business and actually perhaps putting new power plants on the existing sites. Germany also, particularly with the Greens being a potent political force in Germany and anti-nuclear, having to rethink it because of the 26% of their electricity that comes from nuclear and the other things that I've mentioned. Now, Asia. This is where the market is the wild, I was going to say the Wild West, but it's really the Wild East in terms of power and so forth. China's got 9 pressurized water reactors, PWRs, online right now, 2% of the electricity for the country. 30 are in construction. The plan is to have 300 operating. That is to say, generation 2 to 3, that is optimized, kind of state-of-the-art, but pressurized water reactors operating by the year 2035. They're serious about this, because without the electricity, the country cannot continue to manufacture and develop. And they're not so enthusiastic, are they, in my view, about other kinds of power that they're going to be, electricity they're going to be creating by burning a lot of coal, which they also have. They're going to do that too. So the nuclear is just in addition to all the coal stuff that they're going to be putting into the atmosphere. It's interesting how many people are in China trying to do business. It's like the world is there trying to do business with them. Everyone is there. And so we're going to see a lot of demo projects in China in terms of technologies, getting them used, in place. They don't worry about siting problems. They don't worry about public participation. They don't worry about the desert tortoise maybe getting crushed at Yucca Mountain, the endangered species that put that project back about $85 million 1 week just for fun, and so forth. Japan, of all the countries in the world that should be sensitive about nuclear stuff, they've always depended on it. We have 4 new plants, but they're very quiet about it since 2002. 4 new state-of-the-art, sort of early third-generation power plants online in Japan. 12 more are planned by the year 2030, So they're going to have 16 new plants in the next 20 years. They have a breeder reactor that they took offline because it was poorly designed, and they're rebuilding it at Monjou, which is interesting. And another point is that the French are here again. I hope we don't have too many Francophiles in here, because the French are really, this is their business. I mean, this is a national passion for them. They reprocess all of the Japanese fuel. So they ship it back to Cherbourg, and then they cool it off, and they reprocess it. They put it into glass logs. The French hold it in a room about this size. All the spent fuel from Japan, from France, from Italy, and a good chunk of the stuff in Great Britain is in a room about this size. And when it cools off enough, they put it back on the ship and send it home. So the Japanese have got a waste problem that they're going to have to deal with. India, 8 power plants, nuclear plants online. And the Indians, a very interesting thing. India has one of the highest concentrations of thorium in the world, and you can make nuclear power from thorium. It's cool because you can't blow it up in a bomb. So thorium is a very interesting fuel source. The Indians have got a bunch, and they are developing what might be kind of state-of-the-art thorium reactors. Korea's got 8, that is South Korea. I don't know about North. Ask the guy who's going to be here what they're doing, because they claim to be making power plants, but who knows. A brief word, because I'm running out of time, and time that I want to have questions from you guys. But you were 10 minutes into my pitch. Lunch may be a bit late. Yes. Generation 4 is state-of-the-art technology, and it really, the whole idea of Generation 4 was codified in the year 2000 with a forum that was convened of various nations who were worrying about the long term, the 100-year sort of horizon for nuclear energy production in the world. And some people, I guess, were worrying about greenhouse gases, but mainly they were just worrying about electric generation and keeping economies going. And this Gen 4 forum, it was called, was convened, and it was the U.S., U.K., Canada, France, Japan, Korea, South Africa, Argentina, and Brazil all got together, and there have been quiet R&D projects and studies and so forth. The idea was the replacement of the existing fleet, at least the replacement of the existing fleet of nuclear power plants. Now, there are 5 or 6 dominant threads in Generation 4. The common characteristics of Gen 4 is smaller, more efficient, more time online. A lot of nuclear stuff, you have to, depending on how you burn the fuel, in a year and a half average, you got to stop everything, take the rods out, kind of fix everything up, put new fuel rods in. And while that's happening, you're not generating power, it's expensive, and so forth. And so the ways you could design around that is an issue. By the way, the operating efficiency of nuclear power plants currently online, the Finns get the prize year after year after year at something 65 to 70% operating efficiencies, sometimes higher, which is really, for their 4 reactors, which is really amazing the way these guys work. The Finns are tough, the way they run their nuclear program. They're amazing, actually. Now, the pebble bed modular reactor, I'm going to mention it to you because you're going to hear a lot more of it in the coming years, is an adaptation of a German design from the 1980s from Siemens. It is a high-temperature, gas-cooled reactor. No water. So you don't have to be near a source of water to cool the thing off. It's much smaller. You can make it in smaller modules. The thing about the pressurized water reactors is their economies of scale. It's 1,000 megawatts is about where everyone builds them. There are reasons for that. It's hard to build one much smaller and make money on it. And if you build a much larger, like the Finns are discovering at 1.6, that you run into other kinds of problems. So there's a scale factor. The thing with high-temperature gas-cooled reactors, like the pebble bed modular reactor, is you can build them small. And that becomes really important if you're thinking about the developing world or the need to have minimal distances to transmit the power so you can distribute nuclear power, which has always been a problem in the world in the past. The place where the demonstration is going on is South Africa, which I think is interesting. And it involves Siemens, it involves ABB, which is the Swiss construction company, British Nuclear Fuels. And for a while, Exelon was also a participant, but they dropped out a few years ago. And what's happening, two demonstrations in South Africa should be up and running, although they've had technical problems like these things always do, within the next 2 to 3 years. And the interesting thing is that these are cheaper. Oh, MIT is also involved in the PBMs. Quickly, a PBM takes fuel in something about the size of a tennis ball and puts it in a stack. There are 450,000, 500,000 of these tennis ball-like things that have either thorium or enriched uranium at about 3%, the enrichment. And the stack is constantly being monitored. It generates the heat. The heat is then transferred to helium. The helium is then directly fed into a turbine. The turbine turns, you make electricity, and everyone's real happy with the result. The thing is that the plant can't fail. So if the coolant goes, the coolant is the helium. Helium is inert, so it won't react with anything. And they have tested these things in Germany in the 80s, and they've tested these plants. You can't make them go critical. So there's a safety issue, and they have very, relative to a water plant, a PWR, very few moving parts, very few parts by comparison. So they're simpler, cheaper, smaller, and they can be built in smaller sections and then connected as modules, pebble bed modular reactors, PBMRs. So if you need more, you add a module. You can get 1,000 megawatts packed onto a football field. That's roughly the footprint. Give you some idea. The cost calculations, and this is always a big issue, make them competitive. Not quite with coal, but certainly much more competitive, even with allowances for subsidies and one thing and another, with Generation 2. They're much, much better from an economic point of view. Okay. The thing about the loading is that there's constant monitoring of the fuel. And so as the tennis balls, it's like a pachinko machine. As the tennis balls kind of come down in the stack, at least this is the way it's represented, you pull a couple out every day and you look at them and say, oh, that's a bad one. It goes into the waste pile. It's a good one. Put it back in the stack. And we'll look at it again in a couple of years when it works its way down. That's a grotesque oversimplification of what's going on here. That's the idea. All right, so keep your eyes open for Generation 3, which are being constructed already in other parts of the world. Generation 3 are optimized power plants, cheaper, safer. They have all kinds of safety things built in that Generation 2 doesn't. It means that you can have them operating in parts of the world and not worry about them quite as much. And Generation 4, which is even cheaper, safer, and kind of more cost-effective, if you believe the numbers that are being generated in this site in South Africa. By the way, the Chinese are also building a pebble bed modular reactor, and it's part of an MIT, China, and Tsinghua University consortium, and the demo site is at Tsinghua. So keep that in mind, because the Chinese are going to be probably turnkey operations if they've got the technology. My forecast is turnkey operations of a Chinese origin probably in 20 years. I'm really out on the limb here, but I'm sawing. But it's something you all should keep your eyes on. So I've alerted you. Be mindful when you see PBMR. Now, waste. Okay, I can do this. The United States is the only country in the world that was silly enough to have a hard schedule for when we were going to deposit the waste in the ground. We asked the wrong question in the first place in 1957. We asked the scientists, can we deposit waste in the ground safely? A bunch of geologists, this is a National Academy of Sciences report, said, sure. You just got to find the right medium, and you can put waste in the ground. It'll be there. It'll be fine. And they're not worrying about a lot of things. But that was, ask the question, you get the answer you deserve, and we've been living with that. So we went looking around for a geologic site and went through a whole bunch of machinations and eventually ended up with one place, Yucca Mountain, Nevada, and it was for political reasons. It's called the 1987 revision to the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. That's a mouthful. And in Nevada, it's called Screw Nevada. Literally, I mean, that's the way they refer to it, including the senior senator from the state of Nevada. Nevada doesn't have a nuclear reactor, so they're taking in everybody else's waste. The interesting thing is that Yucca Mountain, you hear people talk about Yucca Mountain as this pristine place in the desert with the Goshutes, with the Shoshone Indians and the tribes. It's the nuclear test site. You go down a road, and on the right-hand side is where we've blown up more nuclear weapons than any other place on the face of the earth, underground, above ground, everywhere. And on the left side, we have Bambi and Yucca Mountain. Pardon me, folks, for letting it all hang out here. It's also a very secure site in terms of keeping people out who don't belong there because we've kept them out of the test site all these years. It's really hard to get in. And if you even try, it's hard to get out. And a lot of people try to get in. Let me tell you, they have a regular patrol and cops and the whole deal. All right. There are lots of problems with Yucca Mountain if the objective is to put nuclear waste in the ground for 10,000 years. And that's the way the problem has been defined. Can you put it in the ground safely for 10,000 years? Put it in the ground and turn your back on it, never give it another thought. It's a hard problem because we've never done anything for 10,000 years that we intended to. I mean, the longest-lived human institution that I know of is the Catholic Church. It's only been around a couple thousand years. They got problems, too. I mean, just like any human institution. All right. So what we said in this country was we're going to put it in the ground. Yucca Mountain's the spot. We'll look at this site, turn it every which way. $10 billion so far on site characterization. $10 billion. We're collecting money out of every utility that generates nuclear powers, a penny per kilowatt hour goes into the nuclear waste fund, and the money's being spent. Except it's funny because the money is in the fund, but it has to be appropriated by Congress year by year by year, and if they don't appropriate it, it just goes into the general fund. It's just a shell game that's being played. And this current budget go-round, there's hardly any money to keep it going. So our waste characterization, site characterization, Yucca Mountain in Nevada is coming to a screeching halt right now for want of funds. And that may or may not be a bad thing, because the problem is not 10,000 years in the ground without having a worry. The problem is, folks, and this is where I want to kind of end up, so we've got some questions. How can we store nuclear waste in various parts of this country and the world safely for 100 years, more or less? Can we do that? Not 10,000, but can we be responsible for 100? And 100 is a magic number, because if we don't get the climate change issue at least under better control than it is now, because it's not, it may not even matter. And let me end on that cheerful note and say that it's been a real pleasure, because it took me a while to pull all this stuff together. When you know too much about a subject, you always run over. And I hope that I have made it at least understandable that the issue is climate change. Nuclear is going to figure in the world's future, and I hope it figures in ours, because I don't know what else we're going to do to keep the lights going. So there we are. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that was great. You made it very understandable, and as you noted at the end, somewhat frightening. So we've got time for questions. Let's go quickly, Paul. Then we'll go out there.
In an international context, Kyoto expires in 2012. 6 months from now, there is the big party in Copenhagen. The United States is meeting with China right now. It just begun. And the UN has called a summit for this September, just called it last week.
Right.
What's going on? Are we on schedule? How can all these things be pulled together? I mean, what kind of time frame?
The question relates to a lot of stuff is going on at the UN, relations with China. A lot of stuff is going on internationally. How can all of this be pulled together?
Yeah, the activity is very encouraging, because we were essentially in denial, I mean, and internationally in this country, and doing as little as possible for the last 8 years. where how it all adds up, I simply don't know. The energy policies of this administration are not clearly revealed. You can make some good guesses as to where things are heading when you look at legislation that is being worked on in the Congress. There'll be cap and trade and efforts to use market forces to try to get, you know, the country to reduce the amount of CO2. You've heard my view on cap and trade. It's a very tricky process. It hasn't been successful in Europe, where they've been trying very hard. A lot of activity is better than no activity, so it's a plus, I think. The Copenhagen round, there's a lot of technical back and forth that's been ongoing for about a year, actually, for Copenhagen, the Conference of the Parties. And some of that is very encouraging. Nuclear shows up in many of the conversations, trying to take it a lot more seriously and to think about the international implications of it. The UN component of this, Ban Ki-moon is getting briefings, I know, from the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. He invited them in to talk about climate change, electric power, and the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis has been in the business a long time. Their briefings were absolutely on target and very much consistent with the things I'm trying to argue here and convince you of here. So on balance, I think these are all fine initiatives, probably not enough, probably not clear enough, and there'll be a lot of probably uncertainty and adjustments, but at least people are beginning to focus a bit on what's the problem here. It's climate change.
Okay, Hilly and then Bob, and then we'll go over.
If we forget for the moment the word nuclear in any sense, we have talked about three sources of power: solar, wind, of course, it costs to generate power from those sources. But one source nobody has mentioned that I've heard. Every ocean's got it, every river, every major lake in the world, tidal. How come we don't hear about it ever, anywhere?
Matt Simmons talks about it. Anyway, the question is about tidal power. How come we don't hear about it, and what value is it?
Well, I hope I was clear enough in terms of my own personal view. Anything that looks like it can generate electricity that doesn't also put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, I'm for it. The thing about tidal power is that it only becomes... First of all, we have spent a lot of time and probably not enough money on trying to figure out how to make it work. There's the OTEC project, for example, on the Big Island of Hawaii, that's trying to use temperature differences in the ocean as a way of generating electricity. It just doesn't scale. The idea and the theory is great, doesn't scale. You think about big tide areas like places where you guys live and run your boats and so forth. They're limited in the world, as it turns out. And places where you need the electricity, the tidal ranges are not great enough to make the investments worthwhile. So you're going to get power from some tidal things. Clearly, it will be limited. And my view is, go for it. If you can make a buck on it and do it responsibly, generate the electricity however you can. I do know of a project in the East River where they've been trying to take the flow of the river and also the tidal flux and to generate electricity. They've had nothing but mechanical problems with that thing. And it's the R&D guys are, I don't know what their financial status is now, but it's not good. So tide's great. I'm all for it. Go for it. You know, if you can use temperature differences in the ocean like OTEC, great, go for it. One of the things I thought you were going to say is in response to, you know, the question of nuclear, aren't we going to run out of uranium? That's often a question that you hear. Well, we got thorium as an alternative source, but turns out one of the biggest sources of uranium in the world is the ocean. And it may be the place where we got a lot of it anyway in the ground. I mean, that's not a pressing issue right at the moment. But the ocean itself is a possible source for nuclear power plants in the future. Yeah.
Okay, Bob, and then Tom, and then Steve.
Say a few words about the U.S. classification project. What's its status? What's its capacity? Is it running? And most importantly, what's your view of the soundness of the technology?
The question is about the U.S. classification project, its soundness, et cetera.
It's often called vitrification. And quickly for everyone here, the French probably state of the art in this realm, where you take the waste and you encapsulate it in glass, where it's safer and you can handle it and everything else. U.S. has got vitrification projects at Hanford and also at Savannah River. Savannah River is a place where a lot of weapon-grade products have been vitrified. As far as I know, and let me say that this is, my knowledge of this is now 6 years old, so I'm not right on top of my game here. Things were going well. We're putting stuff in logs. It's being stored safely. And I'm not aware of there being a big problem with it. And in any event, the French have got the state-of-the-art locked up. I mean, they really, really have got it locked up. They've been doing it for 15, 17 years now safely. La Hague is the place in France near Cherbourg where this is a major manufacturing operation for them.
Your colleague Charles Perrault has written a book called Normal Accidents to suggest that the major risk is not, as you have implied throughout, the waste, but is the compounding of incidents. We're having, at our limited number of very old reactor sites, we're having tens of thousands of incidents a year, and the problem that he foresees is the compounding of these, two or three or four of them happening simultaneously, is almost unpredictable. Can nuclear new generation be made safe compared to the existing generation?
The question is about the possibility of the compounding of little incidents in nuclear power that over a period of time, if it all happened simultaneously, would be very dangerous. So the question is it possible with the newer technology that's coming along that this can be avoided?
Charles Chick Perrault is a friend and a colleague. He's now retired at Yale. His book is called Normal Accidents. I encourage anyone interested in risk and the human component in risk, particularly with complex systems. It's the defining book as far as I'm concerned. I have high respect for Chick Perrault. I also am mindful of the fact that any human organization or institution, even when you do your very, very best to make it error-free, still has an element of risk and failure built into it, and that's what he's talking about. And the question is a trade-off, like most of things in life. What do you get on the benefit side for the increasingly low probability of there being a normal accident? We make that calculation not formally all the time. Honestly, we do. And you know, if you want something that is completely, completely error-free, don't do anything. So that is kind of my take on it. It's trying to be more mindful of what risk assessment is really all about. And with the new generations of nuclear power, what are we trying to do? Smaller, more cost-effective, and safer. Safety is the overriding issue when talking about design features of Gen 3, Gen 4. Safety, safety, safety. So in the case of a PBMR, you pull the equivalent of all the control rods out, and the thing shuts itself down by design, as opposed to Gen 2, which was a power plant originally envisioned to run a nuclear submarine by the most highly trained, qualified, organized, authoritarian system in the world, which is what goes on in a nuclear submarine, so that you minimize the risk by having people that are trained right magnificently to do their job. So if you have people who are not that well trained, first of all, you try to minimize the number of people involved. That cuts down normal accidents. But then you try to build the systems that are themselves more forgiving, more resilient. And you never get it perfectly right. We're human beings. And so the question is, how do you account for the cost and the benefits, and how do you minimize the risk? Now, Perrault and I have gone round and round on this, as you might imagine. And you say, well, what's perfection, Chick?
Steve? Steve, I'm sorry, it's the last one.
Well, I wanted to ask about energy conservation, because I really didn't hear anything about
The question is about energy conservation. What can be done about it? How come our politicians are so weak-kneed, et cetera?
I appreciate the question, but I started it by saying if you're trying to prevent, one of the things you want to do is promote efficiencies. That's conservation. So I said it, but I did not use the word conservation. And, I'm all for it. Let's get as much as we can. There are thousands of ways and things that we can do to conserve energy. And the example, if I remember my own pitch here 20 minutes ago, was smart grids. A smart grid system, if it can be made to work and we are willing to pay for it, it's not going to be cheap. It's going to be hard to make it work, which is why the Boulder experiment is really so important to this country. Will allow each and every one of us to see how we are spending electricity and will give us the opportunity to actually, if you do the economics on this right and you set it up in a correct way, maybe make some money by being conserving. Golly, wouldn't that be fun? And using our plug-in cars or our solar panels to put stuff back into the system and get credit for it, among other things. Big problem right now is we don't have the measurement devices. And if you can't measure, you can't manage. That's the old cliche. You can't measure, you can't manage. Well, so it goes for us as consumers of electricity or energy. Electricity in this case, because that's what I'm talking about today. Smart grids in terms of energy conservation and efficiency, hugely important. Now, I didn't mention CAFE standards, that is mileage standards for cars. I'm not so sure that's such a super idea, to tell you the truth. There are all kinds of reasons for that, for distortions that it puts in the system. Witness SUVs that had different standards and ways of cheating and fooling with the system. That's not a great place to end. But let me say on an up note, the conservation is huge in terms of its untapped potential. It just didn't happen to be the thing I was talking about mainly today. I talked about everything else in the world, not that. Thank you all very, very much.
You've been listening to Gary Brewer, author and professor of resource policy and management at the Yale School of Management, on Speaking in Maine. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, it will be archived on our website, mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under Audio on Demand for a listing of available programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.